For nearly 30 years, he's guided his family through a medical catastrophe that includes 78 operations, multiple amputations, treatment by more than 60 doctors and 12 hospitals, 7 insurance companies, and more than $9 million in medical bills. Talk about being qualified to do a show for caregivers. This guy left expert decades ago and went straight to leading authority. Here's Peter Rosenberger.
Welcome, I am your host, Peter Rosenberger. Glad to have you with us. And ever in the booth is the Sultan of Sound, the Ayatollah of audio, the Mullah of music, John Butler.
Oh, you're dirty. I love it.
Ayatollah of audio.
I'm with it. Absolutely.
Hey, glad to have you with us. We are here. This is the hottest show for caregivers out there, banned in 3 time zones, including Burkina Faso, and we are thrilled to have you. It's a show for caregivers, about caregivers, hosted by a caregiver. Talk about all things that give you, as a caregiver, a little bit of a break. We want to laugh. We want to give you practical advice. We want to offer you whatever we can. Weep with you, laugh with you, cut up with you, and let you know that, you know what, you're not alone in this thing. There are 65 million of us who are taking care of a vulnerable loved one. It is a brutal experience. It will test every part of your life, your finances, your health, your profession, your spiritual life, your emotions, your body. Every part of your life is going to come under the pressure of this thing, and we want to be able to reach out and offer a lifetime of experience to offer a lifeline of hope. That's what we do here. So we're glad to have you along. I've got a very, very good friend of mine, and I've known him for a long time. I don't want to say we're old. What was Jesus like in first grade, Rob? But it's this is Rob Galbraith. And Rob, a longtime Nashville veteran musician, songwriter, publisher, producer, been around for forever. In fact, we were riding over here together, and he was telling me at the old days, John, about WLAC back in the, when was that, late 60s, early 70s?
Well, they were there, I guess, during the 50s and 60s, but I got to meet John Richburg had a show on there late at night, and they were downtown, like on the
at the Life and Casualty Building.
Life and Casualty Building, yeah.
And that's where we got the name, WLAC.
And 60s, early 70s, sometime, I don't remember exactly when.
Well, at nighttime, they would turn on the big blowtorch, and it would go out to 28 states, still does. And, yeah. And so they were playing all this R&B music back then. I didn't know this. And evidently, Nashville, you know, Memphis was known for the blues, but Nashville became a real breaking ground for a lot of R&B artists.
Well, John Arnn then broke a lot of stuff back before Memphis, even before Stax Records happened. I mean, that was back in the 60s, but John Arnn and those guys, we used to listen to radio, and we didn't know it was LAC. Somebody said, yeah, I heard it on Nashville, some of that blue stuff, because about at nighttime, I guess they were block programmed during the day, but at nighttime when we could get them up in East Tennessee, they would be doing, you know, selling baby chicks, and John Arnn and Herman Gazzard and Gene Nobles and Hoss Allen, and they were selling Royal Crown, pomade, petroleum jelly, everything, man. But they played that blue stuff, and he helped break James Brown, Otis Redding, all the R&B things that came out of the Southeast. You know, so much of Little Richard, so much of it came right out of here, out of WLAC. And that's why they're putting, there was an article in the Tennessean this week about, they're putting that African-American Museum of Music over on Jefferson Street. That's where they should put it, because that's where it was all happening, Jefferson Street. Man, I knew about Jefferson Street before I ever knew about Music Row.
That is amazing. Did you know all this, John?
I had no idea, and I work here.
I mean, this station, especially at nighttime, it's legendary. I mean, it goes all over the country. I used to listen to them in Florida when I'd be down there. And at night, you could pick them up, you know, get them from sundown on. And those guys, like I say, the whole Mid-South R&B, and not just Mid-South, but the R&B music, which is rhythm and blues. Before that, it was called race music. Like, I heard the Gladiolas doing Little Darling, dun, 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 dun. Remember that?
I was just a child when that came out, Rob.
Later on, I remember their version, which was on Accelerec, which was Accelo Records across the river over there at a studio. And I heard that, and then later on, the Diamonds covered it for the white folks. You know, we used to hear all this music, man, Ray Charles, Little Richard.
Little Richard used to say Pat Boone stole all of his stuff. Well,
thank God I never heard Pat Boone singing those songs. I mean, I know he's a great guy and he's raised here in town, but I heard the Little Richard versions. I can't imagine Pat Boone doing Tutti Frutti.
Well, by the way, you know, he did that that heavy metal record. Did you ever hear that?
No, Pat Boone did.
He cut a heavy metal record But it was all with big band stuff.
The big band's
charts are great, but he's doing Panama, he's doing Stairway to Heaven, all that kind of stuff. But where they play it? On the Comedy Channel on Laugh USA.
Oh, man.
On Sirius Radio. They don't play it on regular radio. Nothing against Pat. It was the charts were really, really good
anything
on that.
Big band I would like to hear.
But it was funny to listen to him going, Panama, Panama. You know, it was just really funny.
Anyway, what Peter's saying is I've been around, when he uses the word veteran, that means I'm over 50.
I'm over 50.
I'm over
50. Story with his family. There's a reason I brought him on here today. But I want to tell you a little bit about this guy. And the best way to tell you is this. My son, Grayson, y'all have heard him. Grayson subs in for me when I'm on vacation. And Grayson, he co-hosts the show when I'm gone. And he took his girlfriend over to Douglas Corner the other night to see Rob and his band play. They play, y'all play, what, every 6 months or so?
We try to get it together every 6 months. Maybe every
now.
It
used to be called the Rob Galbraith Band, and then I think it changed to what's a half step among friends.
We never rehearse, so it's like a what's a half step among friends band. You know, like somebody makes a mistake. Well, it's part of the charm.
Well, and
we don't want to let the right chords get in the way.
You basically, when you go to Douglas Corner to hear him, you're putting down $10 to hear them rehearse.
Yeah, that's basically it.
And it's a lot of fun. And by the way, they're on YouTube. I was looking. There's a video of you guys with Clifford Curry. YouTube.
Clifford came up one time and we did that song that Temp set out called Shaky Ground. He got up and did his whole shtick.
You did a good job. And at one point, though, they're playing it and Clifford's up there dancing. And then you just get up and walk off the stage.
I walk off the stage because, you know, they don't need me there right then. I just walk out and talk to some people. Like, can you believe this? This is wonderful. Clifford's up there doing his normal 1965 fraternity party routine. You know,
on YouTube, there it is. Rob just, okay, well, I'm going to take a break while the band keeps playing. I thought that was really funny. But so we're over there watching this thing, and Grayson told me, this is what he said earlier that day. He told me this later that night, but he said earlier that day, he had been doing a video for some big name acts here in town. I mean, A-list country singers. And he was shooting, he was an extra there, and he does a lot of that. And he said, in between takes, these big name acts, and I'm not going to mention who they are because I'll get in trouble, but they all tried to jam a little bit. Each of them had a guitar, and they all tried to jam, and they couldn't do it. He said, Dad, they sucked. Can I say that on the air, John?
I think you're all right.
All right, so it's they
go
were doing
this a lot.
Then, but he said he was watching you guys, and you had Bruce up there, and you had Chester, and you had Roy Vogt was playing on bass, who was a professor at Belmont when I was there, an adjunct professor, and just great musicians. He said, man, these guys were up there. They're the real deal. And I said, yeah, they're the real deal. He said, but that was Mr. Rob. He said, that's the guy that used to come over our house and eat pinto beans. And see, there's a whole contingency of these veteran Nashville players that every now and then I'd make a big old mess of pinto beans and some cornbread, and they'd come over here. Archie Jordan would come over to the house and have some, and you come over there. And so my sons grew up knowing you only as the pinto bean guys. They had no idea what you guys were doing musically.
Well, basically, David Hungate kind of taught me into doing that. He's a bass player here in town, we did that about 5 years ago. We play like once every 6 or 8 months or something like that. But I basically just serve as the female chick singer. I just try to get the song started and then spend the next 4 minutes trying to figure out how to stop those guys. You know, they can play. There's some serious.
Oh, yeah. I like what Bruce said between when y'all did one song. I don't know if it was Shaky Ground or what it was. Maybe it was Mustang. Oh, it's Mustang Sally. Y'all doing a cover, and said, look, on this stage, there's like who knows how many gold and platinum records that we've all played on, and that's all about to crash down on us right now.
Right now, we're going to blow that out.
But it was just a lot of fun to watch you guys, and that's a part of Nashville that a lot of people just don't get to see because they're these real, no kidding players who know how to get up there and just do it. And the ones that can, just do, and y'all did. And you've been around this town for a long time. You've been producing Ronnie Millsap for years. You've worked with Kenny Rogers. You've worked with everybody. One of the things that, and I get to say that I am 2 degrees away now from Kevin Bacon.
Oh yeah,
because you and Michael Bacon used to work together when you were. Now, was it the Rob Galbraith Band back then?
No, there were four of us, and we all had record deals on various labels. So, Don Potter, Bette McGrath, myself, and Michael Bacon, and Don and I produced an album on Michael. He came down from Philadelphia down here for a while, and we met him. And then when he moved. I guess he was still down here when we played some, but we used to go up and we played Philadelphia some, and his brother the actor Kevin was like 16 at the time.
And this is before he even did Animal House.
He was still in high school.
Yeah, he was just a kid.
No, he was a kid. He about got me killed.
Actually, he was on Friday the 13th. I think that was one of his first big movies. And he got...
I used to stay with him when I'd go up to New York sometimes. It was more fun to stay with somebody than stay in a hotel. When I first started the publishing company with Ronnie, and I'd stay with Kevin in this quote-unquote pad. It was some hooker-infested building on Upper Broadway up through there, man. And literally, all he had was a mattress on the floor. There was a grand piano in there that his roommate, who I never met, was an accompanist. And there was a pad on the floor, and that was it. There was no furniture, no nothing. I'd meet him after work, and we'd go, that's where we slept. And I met him. He was working at I think it's called the All-Star Cafe. It was the cafe on 72nd there across the street from where the woman, if there was a movie called Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Yeah.
And the woman worked with handicapped kids and such, and she got murdered. And there was a movie about it. And this cafe was where he was working, where she met the guy, and she lived actually across the street. But I'd meet Kevin, and we'd go wandering around. But, yeah.
He was just a kid. This was way before Footloose.
I think he was telling me about that movie he was getting ready to do, Animal House.
Yeah, Animal House.
He played the good guy.
He was the cadet.
Yeah.
Oh, that was hysterical. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll be right back. We're talking with Rob Garbutt. He's got a story that you are not going to want to miss.
Unbelievable.
Folks, I tell you.
I'm not sure which story that is right now.
We'll make it up for you. But we're going to be playing some of the songs of Ronnie's and some of the songs of Rob's that from Ronnie's new record and from Rob's stuff in between on the bumper. So don't go away. We'll be right back. This is the Peter Rosenberger Show.
All you want to do is ride around Sally.
Caregivers, we're going to give you 1 hour just to be able to breathe a little bit, cry a little bit, laugh a little bit, groove a little bit. That's my friend Rob Galbraith doing his hit song, She Ain't My Baby. Was that a Billie Jean knockoff?
No, I don't know. That was just a tune I wrote a long while back, Billie Jean. Of course, maybe a little bit more involved than Billie Jean.
Yeah, I would think so, Rob. You use those non-sanctioned chords. Well, that's and we're playing some of Rob's stuff. Rob's got a tremendous story that his family has journeyed through, and we're going to be talking about that. I'm glad to have him with you. If you want to be on the show, by the way, 615-737-9522. 615-737-9522. If you're listening on iHeart across the country, it's 1-800-688-9522. 1-800-688-9522. But if you want to call in, be glad to take your calls. Rob is bringing a lengthy history of Nashville and the music business, but also his family has a very personal journey of dealing with some very tough heartache. And they had a son that was born with severe special needs. And this is back in a time when they didn't have a lot of community around them to be able to even know where to go. You didn't have the internet. You didn't know how to ask questions. You didn't know what the questions were, much less the answers. And so one of the reasons I do this show is to grab as many people by the collar and say, hey, look, you're not alone. Rob, when you guys had this tremendously challenging thing as a young couple, when your son was born, you felt isolated, all alone. I mean, what was that like?
Well, I think anyone would. Mary went in the hospital like at 11:30, everything wonderful. About 12:30, the doctor comes out and says, told me about a problem. Then he drew a little diagram, a picture of a skull there with this quote-unquote cyst that the child was having, that he was having trouble getting the child out. And that's the old phrase, he could have knocked me down with a feather, because that cyst that I thought a little bump, it was about a third of the size of the head. And Jonah, they managed to get him, he managed to get born. Merrill pushed him out right before the doctor was going to basically puncture that thing, which would have killed him, and got him out. And then they put him over there on a metal gurney of some kind. Didn't even suction him. They just figured, you know, they probably thought it was best that he die. And they figured he would. They didn't expect him to live 10 minutes. Well, he's pretty strong. And then the next day we had him transferred to Vanderbilt, and he got where they kept from intensive care for 3 weeks. But, that you know, I went to the doctor, the OBGYN, a couple of days later, just went to his office, asked him for some advice of what do you do, and he just said, take it home and love it. Take it home and love it. You know, he had no idea. And so for several years, Merrill and I you feel like you're the only ones who got that problem. There are obviously others, but you don't know them. And I guess when Jonah was about, must have been 4 to 5 years old, when we found the Kennedy Center. Now, he wasn't Downs. He was born with a thing called an encephalocele, which was because of that, and it was near the occipital lobe. I figured he'd be blind, but having worked with Ronnie and Ray Charles, been an idol and met him and such, I thought I can handle blindness, you know. But he had in this cyst thing, he had a decayed brain tissue and spinal fluid, and Jonah had cerebral palsy, all kinds of problems, a lot of serious problems. But I've never met anybody or any animal that's ever had that much a desire to live. And I wouldn't want anybody else in the world to have to go through that. But I got to tell you, man, it sure did enrich my life. It puts a lot of things in perspective.
Well, it does.
It's been the hardest and the best thing I've ever been through.
That's why I had you on the show today, and we're going to talk some more about that. We also do this thing, and I want to go, as we go to the bottom of the hour here, we do this thing with Moments with Gracie. And Gracie, my wife, who is one of the reasons I do this whole thing, is she's been just an incredible trooper.
She was the catalyst that caused this whole thing.
She is. She tells me that.
She reminds you.
Hey, buddy. But she is. And you talking about a fighter. And I wanted today's moment with Gracie is one where she was walking for the first time as a double amputee. And I'll never forget that day in the hospital room. And it was a pretty powerful moment. She'd already been an amputee for 4 years with her right leg. And you remember that you were there.
Yeah, I remember.
And so, anyway, she's taking this. This is from this. So I wanted to hear, this is called 10 Steps, and I thought you enjoyed this today. So, John, tell us about this moment with Gracie.
Today's Moment with Gracie is sponsored by Standing with Hope. If you put an artificial leg on an amputee, he will walk. If you teach and equip a man to make artificial limbs, hundreds will walk. And if you do both while sharing the gospel, you equip them to continue standing with hope. Here's Gracie.
Get your butt out of that bed, my prosthetist boomed loudly as he entered my hospital room. Jerking awake from what seemed like only seconds of sleep, I groaned, "It's still early. Go away." Unaffected, he groused, "Hurry up, I ain't got all day." Since meeting Jim 4 years earlier when my right leg was amputated, I'd grown accustomed to his less than gentle bedside manner. A week after the amputation of my second leg, his 6-foot-5-inch frame barged into my room, ready for business. I opened my eyes one at a time and reached out to grab the trapeze bar hanging from the frame over my bed. I noticed Jim unpacking my new leg out of a bag he carried over his shoulder. Peter handed me my right prosthesis and helped me put it on. Jim knelt down and helped me put on my new leg while Peter positioned the walker. Only 29 years old, I felt like an old, decrepit woman. Perched on the side of the bed, I grabbed the walker, and with Peter's help, I stood up. Blood quickly shifting around in my body after long days of laying flat caused a wave of dizziness, and while weaving, I felt Peter's arms around me. As the spots in front of my eyes cleared, Jim came into focus. Standing on the other side of the room, he beckoned me to walk to him. Using a walker and balancing on my right artificial leg was not a new experience for me. While recuperating from the fusion surgery on my left ankle only a year earlier, I couldn't bear weight at all on my remaining leg. I had to learn to hop with my right prosthetic leg while using a walker, so my first step as a double amputee was familiar. My second was not. Balancing myself on the walker and my good leg, I tightened all the muscles in my left thigh and swung my new leg forward. I felt it make contact with the ground, and for a brief moment, I was balanced on my freshly amputated left leg. Holding on to the walker with all my might, sweat began pouring down my face, and I could feel it trickling down my neck and my back. With every fiber in me, I grasped the walker and could feel the strain going up and down my arms into my shoulders. My jaw was so tight, I thought my teeth would break, and the pain shooting up my leg was nearly overpowering. Reminding myself to breathe, I eased forward, almost in slow motion. While I focused on his face, Jim looked intently at my legs and my hips. Never looking down, I stepped forward just inches at a time until I was standing directly in front of Jim. So intent on my legs, he jerked his head back in surprise when I nearly bumped into him. With tears rolling down my face, I threw my arms around Jim's neck and hugged him. Weeping, I could only whisper, "Thank you." Peter, watching from across the room, wiped a tear away himself, and although he'd never admit it, so did Jim. That day, I walked 10 small, painful steps. Reaching the other side of that room became my only reality. I knew I had to make that journey. Whatever God had in store for me was on the other side of those 10 steps. They represented more than a physical distance. Would I coddle myself? Would I feel sorry for myself? Would fear hold me hostage in a wheelchair or worse, even a bed? With each step, I answered every question and more with a resounding no. I was a victim of an accident, but I refused to be victimized by my own circumstances. If I had to live my life without legs, well then by God, I was going to live life to the absolute max that I could. I would walk. This day, I began a new life with 10 steps. The next day, I took more. I'm Gracie Rosenberger, and I'm still standing with hope.
This has been today's Moment with Gracie. For more information, visit standingwithhope.com.
We're back. This is Peter Roseberry. That's Ronnie Millsap, produced by Rob Galbraith. This is his record from, what is this, Lost in the 50s? Or
no, Ronnie's got a brand new CD that just came out a couple of weeks ago on basically RCA out of New York, where he went back and did his favorite songs from the 50s and 60s. And so this young guy I work with named Sam Hunter, he wrote this song. He and his father Joe wrote this song called Summer Number 17, and I told him it's perfect for Ronnie, so he cut this song. It has a 50s type feel to it, and it kind of encapsulated the whole idea of the CD. You know, songs from when you were 17 years old. It was,
well, is Sam the guy who's playing guitar with y'all?
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, he's good.
He's wonderful. He's an artist in his own right. But so when we had this song Summer Number 17, it kind of basically, you know, if you're songs from when you're around 17, it's mainly aimed at people who are you know, over 40 or something like that, for songs from the 50s and 60s, and there's one from the 70s, and he does a couple of duets with Mandy Barnett on it, who's a local legendary singer. Anyway, we did that, and that's what this new CD
is. This is the new one, because I knew he did the Lost in the 50s.
And we put Lost in the 50s on this CD too, but he did things like Mac the Knife, Mustang Sally, All in the Game, you know that, I don't know if you know
that. Yeah, we got
the, you know, Tears on My Pillow, a bunch of things, man. It was
who
wonderful.
Cut that first?
Which one?
All in the Game.
Tommy Edwards did it in 51, and it didn't strike, and then in 58, his record label said, why don't you do one with this new version, this new rock and roll influence? So they thought that was rock and roll influence in 58, and it went to like number one. It was written by a guy, Charles, I can't think of his last name, he was the only guy that had a number one record and also be vice president of the United States. And when the Nobel Peace Prize.
Listen, who needs Google when you have Rob?
I mean, I was surprised at this guy. But he died before the record ever became a success. He just called it. He wrote the music. It was called Melody in A Major or something. Okay,
but Melody in A Major.
Yeah, and then some woman had him put it down, and later on it became this, that, and the other. It's you can check that out. But.
Well, listen, before we went to the break, you were talking about the Kennedy Center.
Well, I want to reiterate or make that point that, you know, we were young and in our 20s and had this severely handicapped and retarded child, and but who had a will of iron, and Jonah. And
Who did you get that from, you or Merrill?
I got it from my father, I think. But he... when we finally met folks at the Kennedy Center when he was 4 or 5 years old, that we were finally around other people. That was mainly Down syndrome kids there, but Jonah wasn't Down, but they were nice enough to let us go in there and work with him. And we were around other people who had kids with problems. And it was just, man, what a relief. I mean, you know, you think you're the only one, but there is help out there. And then later on when we found this angel, Linda Messmore, at Harris Hillman, school, which is a school for handicapped kids, that was like another eye-opening experience. It was just meant so much just to know that there were other people out there and there was help.
Well, and that's the point of why we're doing this show, is that because people feel so isolated by this. One of the things I said about caregivers, we suffer from three I's: the loss of independence, the loss of identity, and then isolation.
Yeah.
And so... when you're dealing with those three things, and by the loss of independence, of course, clearly, you can't just pick up and go when you want to go. You can't do things you want to do. The isolation, you're cut off from your community, cut off from people that, quote-unquote, normal. You know, you're in this little bubble on your own. And then the loss of identity, you start speaking in first-person plural, third-person singular. Yeah. People say, how are you doing? Well, we just got home from the hospital.
Yeah, we just did this.
You know, she doesn't want it, you know. And I'm thinking, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about this thing, and I said, do you have, because he was doing everything himself for his wife, and I said, do you have the resources to bring someone in to help you with this? He said, yeah, but she's not comfortable. And I said, well, I didn't ask what she was comfortable with. Sometimes you have to make unilateral decisions. As a parent, that can be a little bit easier, because particularly if a child can't participate in the decision-making process. And I've said this for years. Somebody asked one time, they called in the show, and they said, what do you do to tell that loved one you're caring for that the wheels are coming off and you can't do this any longer?
You hit that wall.
Well, and the point is, I said, he said, what do you say to that loved one? I said, well, wait a minute, you're implying that, number one, they can understand what you're saying. In a situation with Jonah, there's no way he could process what you and Merrill were going through. You had to make decisions, period, the best you could, yeah, doing that.
It's funny, he had Merrill and me trained. he got us trained pretty much, and he was with us for 10 years. He died when he was 34, but the first 10 years we had him. And then Linda, this angel, I said, she wanted to foster a handicapped child, and she'd had a handicapped brother, so she took him for 10, 11 years, and then he went to assisted living. But Linda made him toe the line, and she took him everywhere. You know, if I took Jonah to a restaurant or somewhere by myself and, you know, people were staring at us, I'd get angry. What are you looking at? You know, at that thing. And so therefore I didn't go out a lot.
They were looking at you, Rob.
Oh, yeah.
They were looking at Jonah. They were looking at you.
He was on airplanes, concerts, everything. He had a much more wonderful life with her. But nevertheless, it was like an expanded family with Linda and Susan. She's like one of the brighter people I know, and just one of the more compassionate. But it was tough. Merrill and I hit that wall after about 10 years of, like, you know, we need help. And because Jonah, like I say, he had a will of iron. Lacey one time asked Merrill, said, Mama, because he's just so strong-willed.
I think he'd been in prison.
Go visit him at the big house.
That's at the Gray Bar Hotel. That's some of your kinfolk over there in East Tennessee. That's his heritage in East Tennessee.
His heritage. Anyway, that there is help out there, and it's tough, and you know,
what did it look like to ask for help?
We didn't ask, man. We were looking, and we didn't know there was such, and then we found it. There wasn't any problem asking. It's like, hey, we're coming over. And then Lacey, when she was two, she was a role model child at the Kennedy Center because she could walk and control her urinary functions and everything. So she was the child that the other kids were trying to emulate. And so she's been around, and she's one of the more compassionate people I know. I think in no small measure due to her having been around handicapped kids her whole life. You know, it's a it makes the people around them special too. But yeah, it's a tough thing.
Well, it's a family situation. Yeah. You don't just have the parents taking care of one. I mean, every child is affected, and Hannah has gone into the medical field,
and she's the same way. You know, they were around Joan and such. It's a like I say, I wouldn't want anybody to have to go through that, but it sure did enrich my life in ways that I never thought it would, and it puts a lot of life in perspective. I mean, just seriously in perspective. It's when you have to deal with something like that, and it's tough on a marriage.
Yeah. Well, and that brings me to this song that you wrote, and if it's all right, can we play that now?
Yeah,
we're gonna play a song here, just a snippet of a song. And I heard Rob sing this the other night at Douglas Corner, and man, I was tearing up, and Rob was tearing up while he's doing it. And you know, I've been around a lot of songwriters, a lot of players in this town, and let me tell you something. This is one of the most honest songs that. And I remember one time I was Archie Jordan, who you know very well, is a longtime songwriter, and I was asking Archie about some stuff and about a song that I was working on. And the first thing he said to me is, those chords don't feel honest. Yeah. And I thought that was such great feedback. And from then on, I said, okay, what is an honest song? And I have never heard a song from a father to his daughters that's more honest than what you just said.
I had this thing for several years, the title, and I wanted to write it for my daughters. And so I did. It's called When She Turns 45.
Go ahead and play that, John, and we'll just hear just a little clip of it, but you'll love this song.
I hope that she remembers when things go all awry and trouble grows. She's more than a wife. She's the reason for my life, and she's stronger than she knows. That I'm around when she turns 45. If he goes crazy, 'cause I have been there too. Lord, I've caused that kind of blues, and it always hurts. Yes, it always hurts like this father hurts for his baby.
You can't write a song like that without being willing to face your own hurts and your own mistakes.
Yeah.
A lot of people aren't willing to do that. Why did you?
I wanted to write that song, and I said in there, you know, I've been there too. I have caused that kind of blue with
that
mother.
By the way, that's one of the best lines I've ever heard of any song. I've caused that kind of blue.
Yeah, that was a shameful, hurtful part of it. But that's, you know, but because of that, and their mother came out of it on the other side. She and I are divorced, but we're each other's best friend. We're kind of like, because of what we went through with Jonah, we're kind of like each other's support system, even though we choose not to live together. We still are wonderfully close.
You're both wonderful people. Listen, the disability itself doesn't cause a marriage to fracture, but you were talking about this before the show came on. When you put that kind of pressure on a young couple, you add finances, jobs, and all that kind of stuff, it brings out such horrific things. And the divorce rate is, last I heard, the figures were about 89 and some change percent for any family with a disability. And I look at my own life with Gracie and I tell folks, and you read in the book, I've had ample time to make every kind of mistake you can make. I have forgotten more mistakes than most people will ever make when it comes to dealing with this sort of stuff. And there's nothing about this is easy. You know, it's a brutal life experience. And that you wrote this to your daughters is just a real testament to them and to your love for them and their love for you and your family. And there were some casualties. Yeah, there's some scars, and there's some things that just can't be undone.
No, but you know, you do when you go through those things. As Marilyn and I, we had, unbeknownst to us, we kind of had some problems back before Joan was born. But once he was born, those marital problems we had were put on the back burner. You just daggone don't worry about them. You got something bigger in life to fool with, and we did. And we were married for a real long time before we finally call that off for different reasons. But Jonah was, you know, he was a bonding situation for us that I'll never have that with anybody else. Mm. With her.
Well, that's great. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Rob Galbraith. This is Peter Rosenberger. Glad you're with us. We're going to come back in just a moment. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Has to fall, but it's all in the game. All in the wonderful game that we know as love.
Kyle, can you give me more Rob, please?
I love that. We need more Rob. That's the next, that's the name of the next, next record. We need more Rob.
Yeah, baby. Hey.
People walking around my place at night. I don't know if it's wrong, but no, it ain't right. You keep looking at the door. I lay it 10 to 1, I know what for. One way loving, one way loving.
I love it. That's got the John Butler two thumbs up seal
of
approval.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the good stuff.
That's a lot of what we do, that type of, you know, we basically a show of 90% ninth chords.
Well,
it's just all nine chords, you know. Nine chords.
You know, but the thing is, I was looking at this, and I was trying to explain to Grayson when he was asking me, he says, why don't people write like this anymore? Why don't people play like this anymore? And I said, well, I don't know. A lot of these people out there now can't.
You know what, Peter? I was in New York rehearsing with some guys one time who wanted me to do a couple things with them, and I hadn't done anything in like 20-some-odd years. And that type of groove, I was working with the drummers and such, and they were asking me how to play it. How to play that. They weren't steeped in 2 and 4 snare and 8s on a hi-hat, and we'll do the rest of it. Instead of trying to play too much. Now, that drummer there, that's Chester Thompson. That's,
yeah, well, yeah.
That's very serious. But a lot of guys, man, just, you know, just...
Didn't he play? He played with Genesis.
He played with... Initially, well, he played. I don't know who he played with originally, but he did a couple of years with Weather Report, which is one of the seminal jazz groups, and then he played with Frank Zappa for several years, and then with not Genesis, but he did a road thing with Phil Collins.
Phil Collins, that's right.
A long time, yeah. He's all over YouTube on Big Con. Chester's a wonderful guy.
Well, and they people, you know, it was fun to watch you because people don't know how to groove anymore because the R&B stuff is just, I don't know. Grayson and I were talking about he's real big into that. Grayson's kind of retro on that. And
they don't hear that stuff growing up sometimes. I mean, you know, we heard James Brown. A friend of mine that worked with James Brown down in Augusta, Georgia. John, you'll get a kick out of this, especially if you know what a nine chord is. It's that stuff that James plays all the time. And some guy down there in the studio asked James, his guitar player, said, what does it take to play guitar for James Brown? He said, can you play a 9 chord? So, mm-hmm. Can you play it for an hour?
Oh, that's the stuff.
That's it, baby. Can you play it for an hour? Well, yeah, God bless.
Can you play it for an hour? Well, that's funny, Rob. Well, listen, back to this, and I want to tie this up in a nice bow, and I really appreciate you being on the show with us. And if you got some static, it's Rob's fault. He's over here playing with the chords. He's looking at these ancient microphones we have here in the studio with envy in his heart.
Putting these RA-20s. I love the RA-20.
And he's
a nice feel.
He's playing. But anyway, listen, one last thing I want to ask you. You know, as you walk through this thing and you grew up in church and you grew up in here in the South, what did this do to your faith walking through this thing? What did this do to your walk with trusting God with this thing? Because you had to go through – I know I did – I grew up in a church, Dad's a minister, and I went through some pretty dark, dark places. That valley of the shadow of death, man, that's a pretty rough valley.
You know, that never, it was something you hold on to, but it never caused me doubt. I never had that feeling. I mean, when we would go to church, it was until we found St. B's, we didn't find a church that Meryl and I would go to with Jonah that was as accepting as that one. But I never really had. I remember when Jonah was born, they assured me he would be hydrocephalic. And so I measured his head every day in centimeters, and he wasn't. I felt I had a word from God. I mean, I'm not somebody sitting here, God told me, but I felt like I got this peace all of a sudden that he was not going to be hydrocephalic, and he wasn't. And now, about 10 years later, he started to have some cranial issues, and they did it, put a shunt in.
I remember when they did that.
But yeah, he was not hydrocephalic early on, man. And you know, that was one of the few times in my life I've ever felt just like a, finally got a peace about that, and it felt like it must have come from God. But that as you call it, the journey that I'm sharing with you.
The journey. Share it, neighbors.
Share it. It I never... If anything else, it went the other way. You know, it just was something you had to have faith to me to get through some of these things. Faith and humor.
Well, and
you, humor. I mean, with something that serious for that long, you know, humor was one of the few. It was one of the ways that could help get through it, because it was just, otherwise the burden would be you'd go crazy.
Well, what about when was that point, or was there a defining point where you realized, hey, I ain't in control of this thing?
Oh, I knew that early on. I mean, you know, and then as Jonah trained me and Merrill, we realized more and more we're not in control of it. We needed professional help.
Oh, listen.
But mercy.
Well, you were the one that coined that. I was raised by a pack of therapists. I stole that joke, and I've used it on national television many times, and I never gave you credit for it.
Well, you know, that was Merrill and I both were raised, you know, the old bootstrap thing. You know, divorce is an ugly word. You don't think about that. You just deal with your situation, and we dealt with it, you know. But after a period of time, we finally did realize, I guess after about 10 years of caring for Jonah, that we needed some outside help, not to divorce ourselves from him. We just had an expanded family, and it was a relief. It was Linda, like I say, she's just an angel.
Well, when you have certain folks that are, they can do this. They know how to do this.
She did that for a living at Harris Hill. And the other thing, Peter, is that Linda's one of the smartest people I know, and she also... She knows, I think, on some illnesses, knows as much or more than the doctors do. She is wonderful to have in the hospital. People who are old or infirmed, I may have mentioned this already, you need an advocate in there, man. When she was in the hospital with us, with Jonah, I mean, it was, she could talk the language. She understands.
Well, and I ran into this thing with Gracie a couple of times, and I remember one doctor was trying to give me, he was good doctor, smart guy. But he was pushing back on me pretty hard with Gracie and kind of was giving me some lip on it. And I looked at him and I said, look, let's put this in perspective. I don't have an MD, but I got a PhD in her. And I was taking care of her when you were in junior high school. So let's just keep it in perspective here. Well, and sometimes you got to be willing to do that.
We had one, what we thought was a pretty good doctor one time. I won't go into the doctor, the hospital and all. It was not Vanderbilt, I'll tell you that. And they just, at that point, they wanted, I think the doctor was under pressure. I couldn't believe this from his practice to not deal with a handicapped child. And they just wanted to let him die. They said, it's time to just let him starve to death.
Jeez.
Said it, and they told, well,
it's
he,
like the,
in
dark
the first
ages.
2 weeks, but after about the second week, you know, he'll be in a kind of euphoric state. His vital signs were great. We transferred him out of there the next day. They were trying to put a shunt, a feeding tube in, and they didn't know where to do it. So anyway, he was fine. It just, I was really shocked, and there were some national articles written on that with Merrill, because she was outraged. I had to talk to the people because just put that feeding tube in and we're out of here. Don't worry about it. You know, you're not going to starve this child to death, because he still has another 5 years to live.
But he had a personality.
Oh man, very much so.
And he engaged. And see, I've got a first cousin whose daughter is very similar situations like that, and her husband's a surgeon, and they just said that, you know, she's never going to do anything. She's not going to be able to do this. Well, she's very much engaged with the family.
Well, Jonah had a personality. He was very strong. He, you know, so much so when he died, I was right there right after he died, and you see that shell of a body, and it's a very strong feeling that Jonah didn't die. His soul didn't die. He just went somewhere else, and thank God he finally had a level playing field, because he had this body he had to deal with. But his personality was stronger than just about anybody's I've ever met. He was... We called him Bear. He was a bear.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember you called him Bear.
Well, he was a trip.
Is there one last thing? Anything you want to say to couples that are finding themselves with a special needs child, whether it's through a traumatic brain injury? Because I've known people like that have had it. You don't really. There's no preparation. In my case, Gracie was already hurt when I married her, so I had some inkling. But in your case, man, like you said, you went to the hospital, everything's fine, boom, all of a sudden your whole world changed.
I would just say once again, you know, there is help out there. Hang on. It's like a therapist told a guy one time, said the guy was distraught about things, and he said, and the psychiatrist told him, said, I don't know either. I don't know how you're going to get through this, but you will. You know, you will get through these things, but it can get easier based on getting around some, you know, with some help you can get, and getting around some people who have gone through this before you. Simple as that.
Well, did you ever see We Were Soldiers?
No.
Great movie. Mel Gibson playing Colonel Hal Moore. And when everything, when all the crap was hitting the fan, everything else out in the battlefield, he said, we're going to take that creek bed. We're going to take this. And you just want literally one little tiny thing. You don't think about all this other stuff.
You can't think too far in front, man. You got to, you know, it's because it's too real right then.
Yeah, it is. It's too, you know? That's the word we're going to end on right now. Well, John, we're going to take us out. What are we going out with here, John? Oh, this is, I did this for Ronnie because after I talked to you that day, and then I talked to Archie that day, and Archie wrote this song with Hal David. Yeah. And this is Ronnie's huge, huge mega hit. It was almost like a song. I think that's what we got here, John, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And so hit it. We'll take it out. This has been Rob. Rob, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.